Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
So we today are in the Torah portion Pinchas. I'll look at Phinehas in English. Pinchas is the man's name. It is consistent of the book of Numbers, starting in, chapter, I think it's 25, 26. Let me double check that. In middle of chapter 25. So Numbers chapter 25. Starting on verse 10, is the Torah portion for Pinchas for today. Now, I'm not going to read through all of it, just through certain sections of it. Some of this is repetitive in its nature of the countings and such, which is a few chapters into it. A certain focus, certain points we'll be discussing. So, Numbers 25, starting in verse 10. Yehovah spoke to Moses, saying, Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen, turned back my wrath upon the children of Israel when he zealously avenged my vengeance among them. So I did not consume the children of Israel in my vengeance. Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his offspring after him an eternal covenant, a priesthood, because he took vengeance for his God and he atoned for the children of Israel. The name of the slain Israelite man who was slain with the Midianite woman was Zimri, son of Salul, leader of a father's house, the Simeonites. And the name of the slain Midianite woman was Cozbi, daughter of Zur, who was head of the peoples of a father's house in Midian. Yehovah spoke to Moses, saying, harass the Midianites and smite them, for they harassed you through their conspiracy that they conspired against you in the matter of Peor, in the matter of Cozbi, daughter of a leader of Midianite, their sister, who was slain on the day of the plague in the matter of Peor. Before we go in the census, discuss chapter 25 a little bit. The census is chapter 26 and such. So if you recall correctly, the details about the Phinehas and what had happened to him and what he had done to the Simeonites, or at least the leader of Simeonites. The Simeonite man, his name, of course, was, as it's given here, Zimri. He's a Nasi. Now, for those who are not familiar with the terms of Nasi, which says leader here, leader of a particular house. So, in Jewish tradition, at least for the past few couple thousand years, a Nasi is the elder of a house, not just like an important person. He's the elder of that family. So if he is a Nasi within the family of Simeon, that means one of the sons, the lineage of Simeon. Simeon had a few sons, and they each had their own family groups. That means this particular one was in charge of one of those groups. He was the leader of that whole family head. Now that's relevant because it makes a little bit, explains a little bit as far as Phinehas's character, as well as the other people we're going to study today, in their nature and what they were focused their attention upon. Why, what would inspire them to do this, and why others were not inspired to do it. That's a big key difference. What makes someone inspired to do something while everyone around stands still? The Spirit, something moved you, and what moves you? That's what we're discussing, because to me, this is my personal Daniel Agee's viewpoint, when a character in our Tanakh anywhere, in the New Testament as well, acts out of place, meaning doesn't follow the way the instructions of the Torah are, but yet is successful, I am attracted to study that character. Because, okay, what is it God saw in this individual? Because mind you, did Phinehas, did he put Zimri on trial? No. Was he arrested for any point in time for what he was doing? No. Now, was Phinehas the high priest? No. Was Phinehas the judge, meaning Moses, at this time in his life? No. So he went outside his normal realm of authority and did something that we would say, oh, vigilante justice. What are you doing? Vigilanteism. We don't do that. And yet God says, good job. So this is a person worth studying. Why is that? What is God trying to gather my attention about this individual? Phinehas is not the only one in our Bible, biblical history who does things that are strange, abnormal, but yet God says, good job. And I say strange, abnormal, I mean outside Torah's explicit instructions, but yet God says, good job. The reason I focus on these particular characters, personally speaking, is because that explains a lot to my own head where the New Testament authors come in and say, wait a minute, there's a law, but then there's something that is greater than, which is not necessarily following the detail of the law. Sometimes you're just outside that to get the right thing done and then come back to it. Not to leave it, but step out to do what is right and then come back to it. There's a distinction. And these characters do precisely that. We're going to study a little bit about Jehonadab today, Pinchas, obviously, as well as a little bit on a Messiah's character, what he has done, and a little bit about Jehu. These men are, some of them follow the Torah in some varying degrees. Some of them are far outside at different times in their lives. And yet God says, good job. Well done. So that's interesting. Why is that? Well, we have to learn something about the character of a person because the character teaches us more about our God than just the instructions. Does that make sense? Okay, so Phinehas went outside this realm. Now, I want to point out something to you in the census. We're not going to study in great detail of the census, mind you. In the census, it goes through all the different characters and peoples and such. It, of course, counts them, and we go through the list. In the census, we have distinctions as far as how they count them, and there are certain tribes that grow in size the past 40 years, and certain tribes shrank in size the past 40 years. And it's possible, can't say for certain, that this story of the Midianites is one of the causes of a particular house being shrunk. So, verse 26, it was after the plague, Jehovah spoke to Moses and Eleazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen, saying, take a census of the entire assembly of children of Israel from 20 years of age and up, according to their father's house, all who go out to the legion of Israel. Moses and Eleazar spoke to them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan near Jericho, saying, from 20 years of age and up, Jehovah has commanded Moses and the children of Israel who were coming out of the land of Egypt. And of course, it goes through Reuben. I'm not going to go through all these details. But this census is a little bit different in that it goes through Reuben and cuts them out through families. The previous census did not. First of all, it says the sons of Reuben were Hanok, Hanokite family, the Pulite family, and the Hezron, the Hezronite family, and the Carmonite family. These are the Reubenites. Their count was 43,730. And the sons of Pulul, Eliav, the sons of Eliav, Numuel, and Dathan, and Abiram, the same Dathan and Abiram who were summoned by the assembly, who contended against Moses and Aaron among the assembly of Korah when they contended against Jehovah. Then the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them and Korah with the death of the assembly. When the fire consumed 250 men, they became a sign. The sons of Korah did not die. What does it tell you? Now, all of them followed him. So the sons of Korah, of course, he himself followed, but not everybody who followed him agreed with Korah. Even his own children don't say they agree with him. But I want to point out something to you. The previous census that we can study back earlier in the book of Exodus doesn't list the family names as far as which family groupings, how it's all divvied up. Well, this one does. And for one of the reasons it does is that some of the families are gone. The new census, some families, whole families are missing. That wasn't in the previous lists. So, well, what happened to them? Take a guess. They died out. 40 years, there are some families that didn't succeed. Interesting to note. In particular, we have Benjamin who's lost five sons. Five families are missing in this list. Simeon lost at least one or two. Asher lost one. There's a few families that are just plain gone. No, either they probably died out for different reasons over the past 40 years. I can't say whether they necessarily left or not, but they're not listed here anymore. And I want to point that out to you because, note, God is the one who's in charge of all these. He knows what's, of course, happening, of course, how these things are occurring. So Simeon lost one family from his, Ohad is now missing. Asher's missing Esbon, his family's gone. Of course, Benjamin has lost five of his sons and their families, the corollary to them. What I want to point out to you, however, which is still interesting, in verse 46 of chapter 26, which I find interesting because this is not normal, is that verse 46, it says, the name of Asher's daughter, Sarah. So the sons of Asher, sorry, verse 44, right? It's the sons of Asher, according to their families, of Imnah, the Imnite family, Ishi, the Ishivite family, and Bera, the Berite family. The sons of Bera, Heber, the Hebrite family, of Michalel, the Michalite family. They have Asher's daughter, Sarah. These are the families of the sons of Asher, according to the count, 53,400. He is the only one whose daughter has her own family. This is Asher, family of Asher. He is the only one. That's chapter 26, verse 46. So Asher's lineage is always listed with his sons and his one daughter. Always. It's listed here, it's listed in Exodus, listed in Chronicles. It's always because she herself was her own family, her own household, which implies her husband probably passed away relatively young, and her children grew under her authority, her household. So there are matriarchs that are actually in charge of their household families. And he, in his family, he happens to have one, and she is listed amongst them. So I want to bring these are all subtleties, but it tells us transition of peoples and time and place. Because our Torah gives us certain things that the culture of the time did not have, such as women inheriting things, which we have in this Torah portion. We have women's rights, so to speak, being developed, which is foreign to culture at the time and in their existence. But God doesn't view it as foreign. He says, no, this is a real thing. So God is slowly changing their culture. And of course, Asher's an example. Of course, Zelophehad's daughters, which we'll talk about shortly, is an example as well. And what's important, we'll go back a little bit, we started out with, was Phinehas and how he dealt with the Nasi of Simeon. Because that's a patriarch. Now, mind you, a leader of a family's house means he has men at his command. He has soldiers underneath him. He can do anything he wishes. Now, prior to this event, meaning 40 years earlier, Simeon's household had, according to Torah's instructions, 59,300 fighting men. 59,300 fighting men. That was Simeon's family. And this one, Zimri, that Phinehas killed, was in charge of one of those families. So he had whole divisions underneath him. Was he an ordinary man? No, he wasn't. Would Simeon's, all the men who are underneath this particular individual, his soldiers, so to speak, would they be thrilled at his death? Not likely. He's in charge of their whole family, and you're executing him. So what risk, as I bring back this point, what risk was Phinehas taking? Yeah, it's a revolution almost. He could start a civil war. So that may explain a little bit. Yeah, so a little bit as to why others were standing by, crying, but hesitant to do. What would they risk? God's wrath, the people's wrath. They knew what they would risk. Wait a minute, I'm not going to kill this guy. It's no different than somebody in our culture, not say U.S. culture, but the culture of the world, killing a major leader of their country. I believe wars were started that way. It's happened that way. You don't do those types of things, right? Because it costs, it's a high risk. So what was Phineas risking? He wasn't risking just his own, you know, oh, I'm good on God's side. No, he's risked a lot of things. How much trust did he have in his God? A lot. He said, this was worth it. It's okay. This is a risk. I may perish in the process. I may start a civil war here and now, but it's worth it. That's a major risk. It's interesting about it, the man's character, what we learn about him. Tammy, you're microphone, Isaac.
If you think about just in our, I don't think anyone in this room was alive at the time. No one in this room was alive at this time, but it's a recent enough history that we at least know about it. World War I was started because some minor level royal was assassinated. Yeah. He wasn't even the king. He was like this lower level duke of a duke of a duke or something.
Yeah, exactly. An insignificant person.
And it, the whole world went up in flames.
Right.
Whole of Europe, I should say, at least.
Yeah,
went
most
up in
of Europe,
flames.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So this guy's a big deal. It could have easily turned out the same way.
A lot worse, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to point this out to you. In Jewish tradition, in this example, which we've learned about Phineas, when we study and go through these counts of all these different census totals, we note that the tribe of Simeon had a precipitous loss of families, as well as numbers. So we go back to verse chapter 26, verse 12. It lists Simeon's family. Now, mind you, 40 years earlier, there are 59,300 fighting men. Now, this, of course, census is taking place after the deal with the Midianites. So the sons of Simeon, this is verse 12, according to their families of Nemuel, the Nemuelite family, of Jamin, the Jaminite family, of Jachin, the Chinite family, of Zerah, the Zerite family, of Shul, the Shulite family. These are the families of Simeonite, 22,200. They went from 59,300 to 22. They lost like 60-some-odd percent, almost 63% of their population, of their fighting men in the past 40 years. That's the biggest loss of life. And some have argued, as we're just saying some, because the Simeonite leader, the Nasi that Phineas killed, he brought the Midianite woman into his tent, right? Right there in front of God's tabernacle. Yeah. So he had his tent very close, his personal tent, very close to God's tabernacle. He had to be fairly important to have his men that close up to the near door of the tabernacle. He's an important individual because only the family leaders got there. He got there, and of course, the people there are weeping and they're crying, presumably over the death of all the individuals who have been executed from this process. And it's very possible the Simeonite family had the biggest strike against it in this instance, because even one of their Nasi himself was participant of the Midianite infiltration of their culture. Yes.
Is it fair to say that they, you know, like in the last 40 years, a lot of them were involved in all the stuff that was going on because they have the largest thing when the earth opened up and the next and the next, they got a bad curse.
They may have been. There are pieces and chunks missing over time. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of events that occurred. Obviously, Korah's example, different plagues that occurred, things that occurred along the way. So a lot of Simeonites had lost their lives over the past 40 years. And of course, that's a big hit. So it's important to understand that if that is the case, the Simeonites were the greatest impact on the past 40 years, the major losses. What does it tell you about the importance of the leadership of a particular family? Because the Simeon, one of the Nasi his four or five sons, one of those family groups he was in charge of, and that was his person who was in charge of that whole family group of Simeon. That directs the leadership. The leadership directs the individual families. They decide what the families do and don't do. They say, well, we're going to agree with this, or no, we won't agree with that. We'll go along this way, and we won't go along that way. Vice versa. Those leaders are the ones who are decided. They are the decision makers. They decide whether war goes out or not go out, that kind of thing. So when a leader himself is corrupted, how does it affect the whole family? Well, it kills a lot of people in this case. The whole family gets heavily damaged. Everybody suffers, but that family suffers the heaviest. So again, it's important to understand that when you're dealing with leadership, people who are in charge of, we have this thing of oh, well, leaders, are, no one's above the law, but you know, sometimes you kind of are. We have the thought, well, you're not above the law, but in this case, we'll overlook it. Well, that corruption continues to grow. Yeah, Larry, you can comment.
I think I'm getting a little bit lost here. Was Phinehas a leader of one of these families under Simeon?
No. Phinehas was a separate family, line of Levi.
Oh, they were a whole family? Oh, Levi, okay.
He was within the high priest family only, which means he has zero control over the families of Levi. He is not in charge of the three sons, the three families, the Kohath or Merari or Gershon. Those three families had their own separate leaders. So he was only a subordinate to his own dad, Eleazar. Mm-hmm. Only in charge of the high priest's small family only. So he was not a leader of any of the tribes or any of the families at all. His dad was. He is a subordinate to his father.
His dad would have been God by then, though, right?
No, Aaron's dead, but his dad Eleazar is still alive. Eleazar is still
alive. So the next thing was, that, and this fellow who he executed.
Yes.
What family was he in?
Simeon, a separate family.
He was in Simeon. Yep. A different family from
different
Phinehas.
Family. So you had
so he had no legal authority for
no
this.
Legal authority at all. No, there's no right to do anything. It's a separate family, separate everything. But he did it anyway. Okay. And God was blessed, was pleased with him. And what was God's comment regarding Phinehas? What did he say regarding this event and how he treated him? He says, behold, I will give him my covenant of peace. And it should be for him, this is verse 12 and verse 13, be for him, his offspring after him, a covenant of eternal priesthood, because he took vengeance for his God, and he atoned for the children of Israel. So Eleazar didn't do that. Moses didn't do that. Phinehas did. And Phinehas got blessed from God from it. What does that mean? To be a covenant of peace and to have an eternal priesthood?
It sounds like Melchizedek.
It does sound a lot like Melchizedek, doesn't it? You know, in Jewish tradition, Phinehas is one of the oldest priests who ever lived. Traditionally, it's not recorded that way. They traditionally place him at almost 200 years old before he dies. That's tradition only. Tradition only. There's no evidence of it. But that God blessed him because of the type of character he was. Now, priests, the reason they say that is because priests aren't listed again, name-wise, for almost 200 years. Before they actually listen to the priest's name, other than Phinehas. So they argue that he was, it's just tradition. I'm not going to argue that's actually true or not. It doesn't matter. The point is, they believe God blessed him. I want to point a simple question out to you, which you should all think about this, what it means. A priesthood forever. Now I have a question for you. Most of us understand and believe that Messiah is our high priest, right? Messiah is not from the tribe of Levi. He's not a descendant of Phinehas in any way. So what about this promise? Say it again.
After the order of Melchizedek.
Yeah, well, that's what Messiah is supposed to follow, that sequence, right? Right, that there's no ending, no defined beginning, no defined ending. No direct connection, right? All right. So, if there's no direct connection in Phinehas' life and the life of all of his sons, what does that mean? What is this? What is this promise going to mean to them?
Maybe like in the millennium.
Say it again.
Maybe in the millennium they're going to have
like a millennium. Priest. That's an interesting question. Now, in this Torah portion that doesn't talk about it explicitly, we learn a little bit about certain things and characters and God's promises. God promised a lot of things over time, hasn't he? He promised things to Abraham, he promised things to Jacob, he promised things to Isaac, he promised things to even Joseph. He promised stuff a lot, along the way, he promised many things to many people. Has he ever fallen short on any of his promises? No, he hasn't. So is he going to fall short on any promise he made to any of us? No, he won't. Would he fall short of his promise to made to Phineas? No, he won't. So what does his promise mean then? It's not that one of Phineas' descendants would be Messiah, because that obviously isn't the case. So what does it mean? Let's go read a little bit about Jehonadab's descendants, and it might explain a little bit what this means. Jehonadab was a very unique individual, one of the few characters in the Tanakh that I really like, for different reasons. So we're going to jump to a little bit about, we have to do two things. We have to do two different places to read about Jehonadab and the nature of the man, to understand what's going on here and how we can explain the promise God's making to Phineas. We're going to jump to first and to read about who Jehonadab is in 2 Kings. So we introduce who he is, so you don't forget what kind of man we're dealing with. 2 Kings, in chapter 9, we really start learning about and reading about Jehonadab. In chapter 9, jump to, let's see here, we'll jump down. Let's see, we'll talk about that one. I can read the whole story. Okay, I have to jump. To know what Jehonadab is doing in 2 Kings chapter 9, you have to read what's going on. So there's a little bit of history here. So we're going to read, we'll start in verse 1 to tell you what's happening in 2 Kings chapter 9 and 10 before we can understand what Jehonadab is doing and why he's so important of a character. So 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 1. Elisha the prophet called one of the sons of the prophets and said to him, "Get yourself ready, take this flask of oil in your hand, and go to Ramoth Gilead. Now when you arrive at that place, look there for Jehu, son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him rise from among his associates and take him to an inner room. Take the flask of oil and pour it on his head. Say, 'Thus says Jehovah, I have anointed you king over Israel.' Then open the door and flee, and do not delay." Stop there for a moment. Jehu was known for his bloody temper. All right? He has a bloody temper. Verse 4. So the young man and the servant of the prophet went to Ramoth Gilead, and when he arrived, there were the captains of the army sitting. He said, "I have a message for you, O commander." He said to Jehu said, "For which one of us?" And he said, "For you, commander." Then he rose, went into the house, and he poured the oil on his head and said to him, "Thus says Jehovah, God of Israel, I have anointed you king of the people of Jehovah over Israel. You shall strike down the house of Ahab, your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants of prophets and the blood of all the servants of the Lord of Jehovah at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab all the males in Israel, both bond and free. So I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. The dog shall eat Jezebel in the vicinity of Jezreel. There should be none to bury her." He opened the door and fled. Then Jehu came out to the servants of his master. And one said to him, "Is all well? Why did this madman come to you?" He said to them, "You know the man and his babble." They said, "A lie. Tell us now." So he said, "Thus and thus spoke to me, saying, 'Thus says Jehovah, I have anointed you king over Israel.' Then each man hastened to take his garment to put it under him, the top of the steps. They blew trumpets, saying, 'Jehu is king.'" Now we're going to jump a little bit. Now we know who Jehu is and how he got there, because he's going to introduce us to Jehonadab. Jump down to verse Jehu goes through, he kills a bunch of people in the sense of Ahab. So he's in the process of killing these people. So jump to chapter 10, as he's finishing off and he's killing these individuals. We have details of how Jehu's going to meet up with Jehonadab. Now, Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria, and Jehu wrote letters and sent to Samaria the rulers of Jezreel, the elders, and those who reared Ahab's sons, saying, as soon as the letter comes, you since your master's sons are with you, and you have chariots and horses, a fortified city also, and weapons. Choose the best qualified of your master's sons, set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house. But they were exceedingly afraid and said, look, two kings cannot stand up to him. How can we stand? And he who was in charge of the house, and he was in charge of the city, the elders, all those who reared the sons, sent Jehu saying, we are your servants. We will do all you tell us. We will not make anyone king. Do what is good in your sight. Then he wrote a second letter to him saying, If you are for me, if you will obey my voice, take the heads of the men of your master's sons and come to me at Jezreel by this time tomorrow. Now the king's sons, 70 persons, were worth great men of the city who were rearing them. So it was, when the letter came to them, that they took the king's sons and slaughtered 70 persons, put their heads in baskets, and sent them at Jezreel. The messenger came and told him, saying, they have brought the heads of king's sons, lay them in two heaps at the entrance of the gate until morning. So it was the morning that he went out and stood and said, all the people, you are righteous indeed. I conspired against my master and killed him. But who killed all of these sons? Now know that nothing shall fall the earth, the word of Jehovah, which Jehovah spoke concerning the house of Ahab. For Jehovah has done what he spoke by his servant Elijah. So he killed all who remained, the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men, and his close acquaintances, his priests, to let them none remaining. He arose, departed, and went on his way to Samaria. On the way at Beth-Ekid of the shepherds, Jehu met with the brothers of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and said, who are you? They answered, we are the brothers of Ahaziah. We have come down to greet the sons of the king and the sons of the queen's mother. He said, take them alive. So they took them alive and killed them at the well of Beth-Ikta for 42 men, and he left none of them. When he departed from there, he met Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. He greeted him and said, is your heart right, as my heart is toward your heart? Jehonadab answered, it is. Jesus said, if it is, give me your hand. So he gave him his hand. He took him up to him into the chariot. They said, come with me and see my zeal for Jehovah. So they had him ride in his chariot. When he came to Samaria, he killed all who remained to Ahab in Samaria, till he had destroyed them according to the word of Jehovah, which he spoke to Elijah. Then Jehu gathered all the people together and said to them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu will serve him much. Now therefore call to me all the prophets of Baal, and all his servants, and all his priests. Let no one be missing, for I have a great sacrifice to make to Baal. Whoever is missing shall not live. But Jehu acted deceptively, with the intent of destroying the worshippers of Baal. Jehu said, proclaim a solemn assembly for Baal. So they proclaimed it. Jehu sent through all Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left who did not come. So they came to the temple of Baal, and the temple of Baal was full from one end to the other. He said to the one in charge of wardrobe, bring out the vestments for all the worshippers of Baal. So he brought out the vestments for them. Then Jehu and Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, went into the temple of Baal and said to the worshippers of Baal, search. He said, no servants of Jehovah are here with you, but only the worshippers of Baal. So they went in and offered the sacrifice and the burnt offerings. Now, Jehu had appointed for himself 80 men on the outside, had said, if any of the men whom I have brought into your hands escapes, whoever lets him escape, it shall be his life for the life of the other. Now it was so, as soon as he had made the end of the offering and the burnt offering, that Jehu said to the guard and the captains, go in, kill them. Let no one come out alive. And they killed them with the edge of the sword. Then the guards and the officers threw them out and went into the inner room of the temple of Baal. They brought the sacred pillars out of the temple of Baal and burned them. They broke down the sacred pillars of Baal and tore down the temple of Baal and made it a refuse dump to this day. Thus Jehu destroyed Baal from Israel. Israel, northern tribes. I read this story So now you know who Jehu was, and God introduced us to Jehonadab. What was Jehonadab's role in this story? He's a witness. Now, what kind of witness was he? Was he just said, oh yeah, I saw this or I saw that? When he willingly went up into Jehu's chariot, what was Jehonadab doing at that time, at that moment? What does that mean? I'm condoning what you're doing. I'm agreeing with what you're doing. And we say, oh, but it's bloody. It is bloody, you're right. It's grotesque. But Jehonadab was a very unusual character. We'll read more about him in Jeremiah chapter 35 next. And this individual, my focus is not so much on Jehu himself, but the character of Jehonadab. Who did he associate with? He associated, of course, with Jehu. But there's something else he did, which is also abnormal. This man followed God to the utmost, to beyond what most people would do. Yet he threw himself behind a bloodthirsty man. So Jeremiah 35, we read something more about Jehonadab and what kind of man he was. Jeremiah 35 says, "The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord of the days of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, go to the house of the Rechavites, speak to them and bring them into the house of Jehovah, into one of the chambers, and give them wine to drink." Stop there. Rechavites, that was Jehonadab's father. That's his dad. Rechav, Jehonadab, was the son of Rechav. So all these people are the descendants of Jehonadab and his children and progeny, almost 150 years later. So time has lapsed between the event of Jehu and Jeremiah. "I took Jezaniah, the son of Jeremiah, the son of Habaziah, his brothers, and all the sons of the whole house of Rechavites, and I brought them into the house of Jehovah, into the chamber of the sons of Hanan, the son of Igdala, a man of God, which was by the chamber of the princes, of the chamber of Maaseh, the son of Shalim, the keeper of the door. I set before the sons of the house of Rechavites bowls full of wine, and cups, and said to them, drink wine. But they said, we will drink no wine, for Jehonadab, son of Rechav, our father, commanded us, saying, you shall drink no wine, nor shall your sons forever. You shall not build a house, or sow seed, plant a vineyard, or have any of these things. But all your days shall dwell in tents, that you may live many days in the land where you are sojourners. Thus we have obeyed the voice of Jehonadab, the son of Rechav, our father, in all they charged us, to drink no wine all our days, we, our wives, our sons, or our daughters, nor to build ourselves houses to dwell in, nor do we have vineyard, field, or seeds. But we have dwelt in tents, and have obeyed and done according to the word all that Jehonadab our father commanded us. But it came to pass when Nebuchadnezzar king of Babylon came up into the land, and we said, come, we'll go into Jerusalem for fear of the army of the Chaldeans, for fear of the army of the Assyrians. So we dwell at Jerusalem. So this Jehonadab is a follower of God. He has and always was his whole life. Rechav, his dad, he commanded something unique to his descendants. Now, this is why Jeremiah is bringing this out, is because this happened many generations earlier, that he commanded his descendants to do this. They will not drink wine, not have vineyard, not have field, not do any of the things that normal, civilized people do. You will instead be more of an austere or reject those items and live your life in a more controlled form. And they listened. They followed. So Jehonadab is a character, and these individuals are characters that God sees and recognizes is they are listening to their dad, Jehonadab, who made a promise to them, or adjured them to do something, command them to do something, and they're going to follow it. And God says, I recognize that, and I'm going to bless them for it. Now, God, note, God recognized Phinehas for what he did, and he blesses him for it. God recognized Jehonadab's descendants, and God blesses them for it. They're going beyond the requirement. He's blessing them anyway. Why is that? Why does God do that? Let's continue. What was that? Because he made a vow. It's possible. It says, jump down to verse 18 of 35. We'll continue on. This is how God is, after they refuse to do these things, God says, this verse 18, chapter 35 of Jeremiah. Verse 18, Jeremiah said to the house of Rechavites, thus says Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, because you have obeyed the commandment of Jehonadab, your father, and kept all his precepts, and done according to all he commanded you. Therefore, thus says Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, Jehonadab the son of Rechab shall not lack a man to stand before me forever. It's a promise, isn't it? That promise is strikingly similar to the promise he made to Phinehas. That you'll be a priesthood, you have a priesthood, you have a priesthood forever. So God has never been known to break a promise he made. If he has broken one, we know nothing about it. He's not one to break his promises. He made a promise to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. He made a promise to Phinehas, which is different than our Messiah. Because Phinehas has his own children. So somehow God's going to fulfill Phinehas' promise. They honor the commandment. The Jehonadab's descendants honored his commandment. And God blessed them for it. They blessed because they honored their dad's instruction, great, 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 grand, whatever, instruction. Then he blessed them for it. And that means, he says forever, which means no matter what happens, Jehonadab's descendants, they'll always have a male in it. Forever. Whatever happens to Phinehas' descendants, he'll always have a priesthood forever. That means even after Messiah is back. Forever is forever. Jehonadab's descendants, males will be there forever because forever is forever. It's beyond, forever means beyond what you can see. Well, I can see pretty far. I don't know about you. I can picture the future, what God's like. I can see really, really far. Forever is a very, very long distance. It's a long time from now. Bazillions of years. I can see that too. I don't know what it looks like necessarily, but I know it's there. That's good. That's still forever. So it'll always be there. He'll always have an ascendant. He'll always have somebody. Now, but we have to ask our questions, which is what the next section we're going to go to in Ezra. Ezra explains how this forever is going to look like. What is it going to happen? How is these promises going to be fulfilled in our world? Yes, Sharon. Yeah, I'll find that out. How long a bazillion years is? Well, I'm sure if it's not written up yet, I'll invent it and make some money off of it. Oh, he has the answer. You have a bazillion years. Go ahead. Oh. No, go ahead. It's something else. Go ahead, Larry. So in Ezra, he explains how God does this, making promises that are supposed to go on and continue on, but yet we don't see them today. So in Ezra chapter 2, we have an example of how this process works. Let's see, Ezra chapter 2, verse 61. Yeah, starting verse 61. Now, Ezra, mind you, is one who is creating or rebuilding the temple of God and reestablishing a life for the priesthood and all that kind of stuff. Oh, sorry, Larry, you had your hand up? Go ahead.
Finish this.
So in Ezra chapter 2, it explains this happens. So now there are people who are coming, say, oh, yes, I belong to God, or I'm part of this family, that family, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's also Ezra's job to make sure he weeds out the riffraff. Ezra chapter 2, starting in verse 61, the sons of the priests, the sons of Habila, the sons, oh, sorry, I mispronounced that, sons of Abiai, the sons of Koz, the sons of Barzillai, who took a wife, the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadites, was called by their name. These sought their listing among those who registered by genealogy, but they were not found. Therefore, they were excluded from the priesthood as being defiled. And the governor said to them that they should not eat of the most holy things till a priest could consult with the Urim and Thummim. Didn't we just said? Do you realize what he just said? He just said that you may be legitimate. You may be fair, that this is to be honored, that you should be where you are at. But we have to wait until the priest who has the right to wear the Urim and Thummim, the high priest, who is clean, can consult God and God says yes or no. So what does that mean to Phinehas and Jehonadab's descendants? It means they exist and God knows who they are, but they have to wait until they're revealed. Someone who has the power to reveal who they are says, you are still the recipients of God's promise. That's what he's just saying in Ezra. That's what he's pointing out. You have to wait until someone can reveal the truth of your right, of what these promises, this promised priesthood belongs to you or not. So he's telling that to these priests in Ezra. That explains the mechanism by which God's going to fulfill Phinehas, the promise made to Phinehas, the promise made to Rechavites, all the descendants of. He said, Phinehas, you have priesthood forever. That means there is still a man alive today who has the right, as a descendant of Phinehas, to be the high priest amongst God's people. Meaning, I don't know his name, a biological descendant. God's making sure of that. There's also a man alive today who is a descendant of Rechavites, who has, God has promised, you will always exist. And it will always be a biological man, the descendant of Phinehas, and a biological man, descendant of Jehonadab, who will always exist. We may not know their identity. We don't know where they live, but we know they exist. Maybe more than one. Yes. There's no way a man today could verify their identity. Not that far back. We can go back a certain generation, but not that far. You're right. Only the high priest could wear them, and only the right high priest could wear them. The Urim and Thummim, if they existed today, if the Urim and Thummim were around today, they would not work unless the right, correct high priest was wearing or using them. I don't know if they exist anymore. They made them once, they could make them again. I don't know. Was that? Right. And he'll be the one who has to reveal it. The Messiah is the one who has to reveal who these men are. He's the one who has the right to wear that anymore. He's the one who's righteous or holy enough to do it. Everybody else is dirty. So he'll be the right. He'll be the one to right to wear it because he's earned that. But he'll be the one who reveals these promises of how they were fulfilled, how they still exist, how they're still true. There's no other way. Ezra points out, until you have someone who can communicate directly with God to explain this to us, we are in a holding pattern to identify you. Does it make sense? Yes, Daniel. Isaac, you're the microphone.
You know, they're talking about the end times, and I believe the scripture says that God himself is going to gather
all the people. Right. Now, some of them will be from different families, different groups.
Does that mean that, hey, by the way, you belong to the family of Phinehas, and you're coming with me?
I'm not sure how he's going to reveal it, but yeah, essentially.
I mean,
because the only person who could possibly keep track of every descendant of Abraham is God himself. I mean, honestly. The only one who could keep track of which ones are from which son or which daughter is God himself, isn't it? Because there's no way I'm going to remember. There's no way any of us could remember, right? Some of us could be, or maybe not. We don't know. It doesn't really matter, but it's God's the one who can reveal it. And that's fair, it's right. So that's the point that Urim and Tumim. The Urim and Tumim, its functionality was that a judge will go to the high priest, as explained later on, and discuss with when he passed off the torch to Joshua. This is when God wants to speak to you. You must go seek out the high priest who has the Urim and Tumim and ask, and then that will reveal the direction that God's giving through that Urim and Tumim. And then God will explain to Joshua what he must do now through that method, and then Joshua can go and do it. So God, after God talks to Moses dies off, God doesn't speak to anybody like Moses again. Everybody has to go through the Urim and Tumim for God to have direct conversation, which means you have to have a high priest to do that. Well, the only high priest we have now, we believe, is Messiah, which means he's the only one who can communicate directly from God to us and back and forth, meaning give us a conversation. God, Messiah is the only one who can do it. The conversation. We have a spirit of God, but we don't have a conversation with him. One mediator. One person you can have a conversation through. That's it. And it's our high priest is the only one who can do it. Yes, Larry.
I always took the thing when they talk about Melchizedek as having no beginning and no end.
Meaning that there was nothing recorded about that.
That is true.
I mean, it doesn't mean that he was necessarily immortal.
Correct.
But that it just wasn't recorded
right,
because it wasn't important.
Right. That you are correct. In my opinion, and many others too, the terminology with the beginning and end of Melchizedek was the fact that there is no beginning listed for him, no genealogy, and no end, meaning when he died. That's what the term means. It means it's not recorded.
Tangential to what we're talking about, but that's one
it
of
is.
The things. You say forever, it's never going to be recorded, maybe?
Well, in the process of God's promises, it's a promise he's making.
He knows what immortality, he knows what forever is.
Yeah, he knows what forever means, right. We can only interpret what the word Olam means. That means beyond what I can see. Well, humans can see your lifetime, you can also see generations prior, and you can imagine what life will be like a far distance from now. So you can see those things. We can see pretty far. Not forever, but we can see pretty far, though. So God has to fulfill at least through that. Okay, so we study these individuals and the nature of God's promises and these characters who, I pointed out earlier, stepped out of the normal bounds which they were given. So Phinehas stepped out of his bounds given to him. He went into another tribe, judged, condemned, executed. Not only another tribe, but also a foreign princess. Killed them both. Judge connected them both. They're done. And God blessed him forever. We have Jehonadab and his descendants, of course. You know, he threw his hat behind Jehu, a bloody man, in many, many ways. But Jehu was trying to follow his best, for he understood God's instruction, which was very bloody to begin with. But that's how it is. And Jehonadab said, I agree with you. I condone this. Clean up this mess and get rid of these people. They're awful. And Jehonadab said, okay, my descendants, you're not going to follow the Torah's instructions, meaning I'm going to restrict you even more. You will dwell in tents. You will not have houses. You will not drink wine. You will not have the fields, all these great blessings. So when the holidays come around, we have, you know, grapes or bread. Guess what? Not you. You won't have those things. You may be able to buy them, but you're not going to grow them or offer them like the offerings are. You're restricted further, and God says, well done. Not because what he said was well done, because his descendants listened to him. Well done. They listened. The listening of was what God was blessing. Yes. Or if that's adding something. Right. It's the same concept. Well, what's the difference between adding stuff and making hedges around? Well, Jehonadab's doing something very unique in this instance. In that when he's making this proclamation for his descendants, he is shielding them from something which they do not know was a problem. note that the land was supposed to have rest every 7 years. Yehonadab's descendants, the Rechabites, did never had to do that. They never grew anything. So they always obeyed that commandment their whole lives. That commandment was the reason why they get 70 years of exile. Remember that? The 70 years Jeremiah says, because you wouldn't let the land rest. So Rechabites, Yehonadab saw that ahead of time. Hey, descendants, these people are not following God. Don't be like them. I'm going to put this stipulation on you because I know what my descendants will be like. They're human like everybody else is. I'll put this on you, and as a result, you will then be forced, if you obey it, to actually make the land rest that nobody else is doing. So they add in a restriction, and they listen to him. But that restriction also facilitated them obeying a command that God wind up exiling his entire people for not obeying. So you could argue, yes, it is an addition, but it was a great blessing at the same time. It preserved them. Yehonadab was a man who followed God. He knew ahead of time, you don't plant things, seed or vineyard or anything in form, guess what? You don't have to make the land rest, because you are always making the land rest. Yes?
Well, generally, within the law, if you restrict it further, that's okay.
You're still obeying
the law.
Right, you're still obeying the law.
It's not like you're adding something, you're just restricting further.
Your own self, your own personal
descendants. At some of the festivals, they're supposed to drink some wine. So is that going to be...
They did not. But they did not.
Does they call grape juice? Can that be called wine?
Grape juice is a modern-day invention. Modern-day meaning grape juice was invented about 150 years ago. Prior to that, it's always wine. Because if you crush a grape, you have maybe a couple of hours that's still grape juice. Because the yeast on the outside of the grape skin and the yeast in the air will start converting it to wine very quickly.
So it has to be pasteurized.
It has to be pasteurized, which Louis Pasteur invented the process, and Dr. Welch. Welch's grape juice. He invented the grape juice with the preservatives, the bottling, the whole process to make grape juice, because he was Methodist, and Methodists don't drink wine. And they always drink water and place it. They go, how do I deal with this? They, well, let's invent grape juice. So he invented grape juice. So grape juice is a modern-day invention with preservatives and boiling and the process of capping off and sealing it. Prior to that, preserving food was called fermentation. That's what you do. You ferment it to preserve it. Otherwise, it molds and does other problems. So grape juice is a modern-day version. So in the Yehonadab's time, they would not have eaten grape juice because it didn't exist. I mean, you could eat it like literally, here's a grape, crush, drink. You have a few minutes, maybe an hour or two. You could do it that way, but in reality, it doesn't stay that way. So they didn't have the boiling process, the yeast and the fermenting, the capping, the sealing of the containers. Nothing that was developed yet at this time. So they would have had wine. But these men did not drink it.
But where does that come in with when we say you have to obey your elders,
obeying your instructed people who are,
unless they conflict with God.
Right. Here's your answer to your instruction, your key.
We must obey God rather than man.
There is no command in the Torah to drink wine.
So he wouldn't have, and we could look at his thing and see where we...
Yeah. There's no command to drink it. Now, all the offerings say you have to pour out your libation offerings. Those libation offerings were poured out, never drunk. So wine is not a command to drink. So God, I mean, Jehonadab knew that, knowing full well, because he knew his God really, really well, far better than I think most people do, even today. He knew his God well and say, hey, I'm putting these restrictions on you, knowing full well they're not against his instruction. He didn't say you couldn't eat bread, you just couldn't grow it. But he did say you don't drink wines and don't plant vineyards. He did no command that you couldn't do, you couldn't observe, and still follow God's instructions. He's a very smart man. Well, they weren't allowed to murder. Right, because Jehonadab, right. And Jehu is the one who's in charge. So that's the fascinating part. Jehonadab did all these great things. interesting characters. Why I am attracted to study this man. He's interesting, and that he followed the instructions to God to a T, beautifully done. But yet he participated in the execution of who knows how many hundreds of people, and God was not upset. Yeah. Why would God not be upset? So why would God not be upset by this? Is God advocating vigilantism? Vigilante? What is that what he's blessing? On the surface, it would appear that way. Let's go back just a speck deeper in this to explain why God would not be upset with these things. Let's go back to our story of Phineas. When God was upset with all the Midianite women and what was happening, what did he command Moses to do? Take the leaders, the elders, and execute all those who are participating in this act. So God has now ordered an execution of a who knows number of people, just a certain number, I don't know how many, how many there are. So Phineas, when he comes across this problem, well, he is not a leader of any of his household. He's a subordinate. He's the only subordinate of the high priest line alone, nothing else. But he comes along and says, I see a man who was not executed, meaning we did not follow God's instructions. So he is weighing on himself, should we follow God's instructions or, and as a result, risk the chance of a civil war going on? Or do we not follow God's instructions and preserve our culture? What did he do? He chose God's command to follow the instructions was more important. Yes, 25 verse 4, I believe it is. I think it's 4, let's see here. It says all the verse 4 and 5 when Moses instructs the judges of Israel to do so. So the judges of Israel were not taking care of the descendant of the Sea of Simeon. So Phineas did. So in Phineas' case, we would say, well, that's vigilantism. Wait a minute. He's obeying God's command. He saved a lot of the lives in the process. So he obeying God's command in this vigilantism, because he wasn't a judge, but he did so anyway, saved the lives of others. Now let's go bring that up to Jehonadab and Jehu. The execution of Ahab's house and the Baal worshippers. Now, what was God's command to Jehu? Wipe out Ahab's house. Everybody. Now, let's go back a little bit earlier in our memory. What was the story about Elijah? Remember Elijah and the whole fire from heaven? That story? And he made fun of the Baal prophets who say, well, maybe God's sleeping. You know, yell louder. He's mocking them. And what happened to those prophets? They were all executed. That's what Jezebel was mad at him. That's why he had to flee and run away. So Elijah didn't actually kill them. He ordered their killing, though. He said, kill them. And everybody obeyed, and they killed them. So he ordered it done. He himself didn't actually wield a sword, per se. So we are seeing that there are commands that God has given, and then there are people who step out of the command on its outer fringes, the limits, saying, well, there wasn't a trial, there wasn't an arresting. But God's pointing out, says, it's okay. This, outside your normal conduct that I agree with, I'm going to bless because it was a greater value than the other with staying with inside my instructions. Statute of limitations? That I can't explain. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what. Yeah. It said God's wrath was subsided, so I say that statute is done. So he must have said, I'm finished. The point is that God has these measures that he's using, which are not necessarily easy to understand. They're not supposed to be easy to understand. We're trying to understand our God, who thinks differently than we do. These measures that are beyond what we normally would think is acceptable, and yet he's saying, it's okay in this instance. Now, the execution of Ahab's household, what did that accomplish? Well, he was vengeance upon all the prophets that Ahab's household had executed earlier. All their unsolved murders. All their unsolved deaths. The unjustified deaths. He took care of all the, now I'm going to take care of all those unjustified deaths and take care of it now. Now Jehu with all the, and Jehoshaphat with the Baal worshippers. They're worshippers of other gods. They're corrupting Israel. Is their death more beneficial or less beneficial to the rest of the country of Israel? More beneficial. So God's weighing things that are more complicated in our minds than just what the Torah says, isn't he? He's debating things that are bigger than what we see, we understand. Right. When we get in trouble, these examples, the culture says, well, look how evil your people, your God is, all this stuff. Well, wait a minute. God is different than us. He weighs things differently than we do. He values things differently. There's a reason why I said previously, a few weeks ago, we are not very good judges. We're terrible at it. If we were judges, we'd all be dead. Could we judge each other? That was wrong. Off with his head. Our world history shows that. That's what we do. We wipe and kill each other off. Because we have zero forgiveness comprehension until after the fact. Unless it's us. Oh, forgive me. But I won't forgive you. We have these problems. We don't do that well. But God does. Hence, we don't judge. He judges. He makes this judgment. And he makes these characters. And he understands what these people are doing. And he says, I'm weighing these. And these are more valuable, though they may seem negative to us, than the other solution. So, is God advocating vigilantism? No. He's advocating obedience to him, and he decides which is more or less obedient. He can fix it too. Any questions or comments regarding these characters and nature of Phinehas? I'm sorry I didn't get to the details of the Torah portion, but I'm out of time. Any questions? All right, we'll go into go ahead and close in prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for our Shabbat, a day of rest, a day of study and worship and praise. Father, please bless us. We listen to your voice and follow you as best we can. Father, help us to understand what is right, what is just, what is fair, that you are our judge. You are the one who decides, and let us follow. We praise you, Father, ask your blessing the rest of our Shabbat in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.